long weekend and then.
Questions?
Just buzz
it. I actually kind of like her.
Questions? So how about a pop quiz? Not really.
But it says quiz.
No, it says quiz on it, but I'm not doing anything with it except giving it to you. So I realized that we haven't had any quizzes that are on centripetal force. So I thought I would show you kind of what a question might look like with a centripetal force. Say again? Correct. Nothing. The only thing I'm doing this is handing it out. So totally different quiz, different topic, different everything.
The escape, what's the two, what is it? Is it 2G?
Yeah, 2G.
Thank you.
So we're going to have a...
Oh, this is by 3 a.m.
We're going to have a real quiz on Friday. But... I'm always worried kind of about the centripetal force stuff because I think that causes lots of problems, and I realized we had never done a quiz on it, so I thought I would kind of show you what a typical quiz question might look like as a way of kind of studying for the exam. So the quiz problem involves a record player kind of like this, and the claim is that a penny can just barely stay on this rotating disc when it's rotating at 45 RPMs. Find the coefficient of static friction. And kind of the important starting point on this is the free body diagram, right? So if we're looking down on the disk, and here's the penny, goes side view. Here's the penny. If we write all the forces down, of course it's going to weigh something. It's on a surface, so there's going to be a normal force. And the only other candidate force is the frictional force. And we know that this thing is going around in a circle, so it is centripetally accelerated. So the frictional force has to be going that way, towards the center of the circle. I know. So as I say, consider it a practice problem. We'll have a real quiz 6, on Friday, which will deal with what we're talking about today, which is... goes under the title of statics. We've got an exam on Thursday which covers all of the rest of mechanics, right? So everything from energy to torque and things that we're talking about today. Typically we'd have a help session probably Tuesday or Wednesday, and probably kind of 4-ish or kind of 7-ish. And you know, we'll vote on those next time. Tests all have similar structure to the previous one, you know, 12 or so multiple choice questions, 5 problem type questions. And it's a pretty good guess that those problem type questions are going to be energy conservation, momentum conservation, some sort of angular problem, some sort of centripetal acceleration problem, and something that we're going to be talking about from the current chapter. Questions? So we've written down these equations for force more generally several times, but we've never actually used them. So now we're starting to use them. The force of gravity is mg near the surface of the Earth, but as you go higher and higher from the Earth, the force of gravity gets less and less and less. It's important to realize that the astronauts are not that far up. They feel a gravitational force very similar to what we feel. And they are just falling 100% of the time. They're moving so fast sideways that the curvature of the Earth is making up for the distance they're falling every second. And if we work out the physics of that, we find out that the orbital speed that's required is given by that equation. Roughly speaking, something like 17, 18,000 miles an hour for the Earth. In order to throw something up and it not comes down, we can solve that problem with conservation of energy, and we get a very similar equation that just is a square root of 2 different from the orbital velocity. So to hit the moon or Mars or something like that, it takes something like 25,000 miles an hour, square root of 2 times the orbital speed. Historically, orbits were important because they were kind of the first demonstration of Newton's laws, because they have basically frictionless motion. So if you just use Newton's law of gravity, it turns out you can prove what had been observed experimentally with the planetary orbits. Namely, that the orbits are ellipses, so sometimes the planets are close to the sun, sometimes they're far from the sun. For all of the planets, the eccentricity, the squashness of the orbit is pretty small. So the difference between the near distance and the far distance for the Earth is just a few percent. So if you were to look at the orbit of the Earth, it would look very much like a circle. It would be very hard to tell the difference. There's kind of a complicated story about the area swept out per day. But it's a lot easier to say what's going on is that the distance between the planet and the sun squared times the angular velocity is a constant. So that means when it's close, if this number is small, this number has to be big. So it has to be sweeping through a big angle when it's close to the sun, whereas it's not going to have a very big angle per day when it's far from the sun.
I have a question more like orbit. Is there like a certain altitude you have to go to before you can orbit?
No. So yes or no? How's that for an answer? So on the moon, the answer is definitely no. So you could theoretically orbit an inch above the surface of the moon. And all you would have to do is plug in this stuff in order to get that distance. If you try to do that on Earth, you're going to run into air resistance. And you're going to very, very quickly slow down. So you might know that the air drag force becomes really large above Mach 1. And 17,000 miles an hour turns out to be something like Mach 25 or something like that. So huge drag forces if you're moving through the air at those sorts of speeds. So there's nothing theoretically wrong with it, but the force on you would mostly be frictional force from the air. More questions? So it turns, yep.
For that area law, is it just R squared W is the constant?
Yes, yeah. The W is actually an omega. Yeah, this thing that looks like a W is an omega.
Yeah.
More questions? Well, let's take a look at some iQuiz questions from the orbital stuff. So planets have circular orbits, but asteroids and meteoroids typically don't. If this were an orbit of a meteoroid, where would the sun be? Yeah, A, right? Not at the center, at the focus, which is off to one side. So here we have an orbit with some special positions labeled, right? This would be perigee, this would be apogee, this would be kind of a more random spot. And we have none of the above as a possible answer and various questions. So where is the potential energy the least? So I see majority C's, and that's right, right? The farther down you go, the smaller your height, the less potential energy you're going to have. Where is the speed the least?
Oh,
Yeah, see, majority A's. So the satellite has gone uphill in going from C to A, so it's certainly going to slow down. We haven't talked about angular momentum. We'll talk about that on Friday. Where is the angular speed the least? Some people are choosing B. So remember, angular speed is this thing W or omega. So I hope it's clear that the bigger the value of R, the smaller the value of omega. So the smallest angular speed will occur at A. Where is the acceleration the least? I don't like that one. Where is the acceleration the least? So I got a kind of a mix of D's and A's. So the acceleration is going to be the least where the force is the least. And the force is the force of gravity. So we can make the force of gravity as small as possible by getting as far away from the planet as possible. So A is going to have the least acceleration. Okay, so here we have some particles. The small particles have mass lowercase m, and the big particles have mass, the big particle m has mass capital M. And we're supposed to rank the magnitude of the gravitational force on capital M from least to greatest. So what configuration puts the biggest force on capital M? Mix of answers so far. I would be hard put to say what the majority is. Majority might be D, which I don't like. So which of these has the smallest force on M? Two, right? Zero, in fact, right? The forces are going to cancel. And between three and four, clearly four has to have the bigger force, right? Because they'll be more aligned. So the real question is, with number one, they're perfectly aligned, but they're far apart. So what's going to help most, being perfectly aligned, so the forces exactly add up, or being partially aligned? And there isn't a real good way of doing it except to actually calculate it. So for number one, the force depends on 1 over the distance squared. So we have one of them that's at 1 over d, and we have one of them that's 1 over 2d. So we've got 5 quarters of 1 over d squared. If we look at situation 3, we've got these forces like that, and Pythagoras is going to tell us that this force is going to be the square root of 1 over d squared plus 1 over d squared, which is going to be the square root of 2, these whole quantities squared. And the square root of 2 is bigger than 5 quarters. So 3 turns out to be bigger than 1, and 4 is definitely bigger than 3. So we got B. So being close, the force falls off so quickly with distance that being far away costs you a lot. Being close is the the best possibility. Maybe we'll redo this one. I think we did this one last time, but it's worth remembering. So people in space are usually said to be weightless. Why is that? So the answer I fight in my intro astronomy class is people think that it's beyond the range of gravity. That somehow gravity stops when you go 100 miles up. And that's wrong, right? Force of gravity is a little bit less if you're 100 miles up, but not really noticeably less. And we know that the C word is not going to be part of this course. We know that she's going in a circle, so she's accelerating. So it's got to be Galileo's observation that a heavy object and a light object fall together, and so would seem to be set up that way. Yes? So it's not a matter of height. So it's a matter of how long it takes air resistance to make your orbit decay. So theoretically, if we could, you know, suck all the air off the Earth, which might be bad for a lot of people, you could orbit just an inch above the surface of the Earth. So it's just air resistance that keeps us from doing that. So all you have to do is go up high enough so the air is thin enough so that basically the only force acting on you is gravity and you can orbit. Questions? Okay, so today we're kind of talking about situations kind of like this. And this is pretty dull to look at because it's static, which of course means that the sum of the forces are going to be zero. But not only is it not accelerating, it's also not twisting. So we need to talk about what would cause something to twist in addition to what would cause something to accelerate. And the thing that's like a force except causes rotation is called a torque. So if you've looked at specs for car engines, you'll see so much torque, often in this country, often in units of foot-pounds, but more generally in terms of Newton meters. This is a twisting force. And if you've ever tightened bolts on things, you have what's called a torque wrench. So this is a torque wrench. And it allows you to measure out how much twist you're applying to a bolt. Because typically you don't want to over-twist or under-twist these bolts. So this thing is labeled in foot-pounds because it's a metric wrench. And if we're trying to twist this thing, you can see that we can apply some amount of torque that we can read off on this meter. Now I have to push pretty hard. I have to push pretty hard on this thing in order to get a noticeable torque. But I'm sure you know that if I have a longer lever arm, I can apply that same torque, you know, with just one finger. So the twisting force that you get depends not only on how hard you push, but where you push. And of course, it's perfectly clear, I hope, that if I try and twist this by pushing this way, I achieve exactly nothing. The only amount of twist that I get is by the piece of the force that's perpendicular to the radius that I'm twisting on. Okay? So if we think about this more generally, if we are trying to twist something about this origin, and we're going to try and twist by applying a force, let's make it more general. We're going to apply a force kind of at an angle, then the only thing that's going to matter is the distance that we are from that twist, and not what the full force is, but just what the perpendicular component of that force is, right? This piece of that force accomplishes absolutely no twist. It's only the perpendicular piece that does. So the torque then, usually denoted by the Greek letter tau, is going to be R times the perpendicular component of the force. Now, if you want, you can work that backwards, because it doesn't really matter where I apply that force as long as it's on this line. So I could also say the perpendicular distance to that line of the force, the torque is going to be that distance times the full magnitude of the force. So these are all equivalent formulations. And if I want, I could, for example, figure out what this perpendicular component of the force is. And you can see that it depends on the sine, it depends on this angle. It's actually the magnitude of the force times the sine of that angle. So a third formula for torque is going to be R times F times the sine of the angle between the application point of the force and the direction of the force itself. Okay, so all of these work equally well in order to calculate what the torque is. And I hope you can see that the units of torque are going to be the units of force times distance. So in the metric system, it's going to be Newton meters. This quantity here often crops up in calculations. So that's the perpendicular distance from the line of action of the torque to what you've chosen as the origin. That's often called the lever arm. Okay, so if this is my origin and this is where I'm applying this force, so let's say I'm twisting like that, what angle am I talking about exactly? Well, it turns out yes is the answer. You can use that angle if you want, or you can use this angle if you want. The sine of those angles is exactly the same. Okay. So torques cause twisting forces. And if we're going to have something that's static, then if we add up all of the twisting forces, we better get zero. And of course, it also better be true if we add up all of the forces in the x direction, we better get zero. Otherwise, there's going to be acceleration. And if we add up all of the forces in the y direction, we better get zero. So those three equations are the equations of static equilibrium. It doesn't rotate and it doesn't accelerate, it's just going to sit there, which is desired characteristic for a bridge. Now, sometimes adding up all of these torques is a little bit different, a little bit difficult. So if we were to try and figure out what the torque was of gravity on this rod, we would have to say that this atom has a force of gravity that's down and it's at some distance, r. We'd have to add all of those things up for every atom that makes up that, that rod. So that sounds like a complicated thing, but it turns out that there is a simplification that works. And that is, it turns out that for an extended object, we can treat it as if it were a point mass. So for any old complex object, it acts, in terms of gravity, it acts as if all of its mass were concentrated at one single point. And that single point is called the center of gravity. It's also called the center of mass. Same thing. Our book prefers center of gravity. Okay, so this somewhat complicated object, it's hanging right below my support point. So the support point has to include the center of mass. Or center of gravity. If we look at a more complicated object whose center of mass might be hard to figure out, the center of mass of this object has to lie right below my support point, right? Because that's how a point mass would end up. But I can change the support point, right? So I can hold it here instead, and it has to lie right below that line too. So where those two lines intersect, that tells me exactly where the center of mass is on this arbitrary object. Right? Because the whole idea of a center of mass or center of gravity is that we can treat a complicated object as if it were a point object, and we know a point object would hang right down from the support mass. Okay, so this thing here, this little kind of fakey bird, it seems to be balancing on its beak. So it must be, it's kind of hard to believe, but it must be that the center of mass of this thing has to be just a little bit below the beak. Right? Otherwise, it wouldn't have this kind of funny location. Okay, so here we've got a ramp that is clearly going down, but some things go up the ramp. It's clearly tilted down, but some things will go up the ramp. Go up. Up. Some things don't obey, like cats. Okay? So I hope it's clear what's happening. This thing is kind of tricky, right? So when it's on this position, its center of mass is high, but when it goes down here, its center of mass is actually going down. So even though the bulk of this thing looks like it's going uphill, in fact, the center of mass is going downhill. The center of mass has to act like a point particle. Okay, so here we have kind of a, I guess this is leaking. That's interesting. So here we have kind of a funny thing that's in equilibrium. And the only way this is possible is over this pretty small support base, the center of mass must be sitting. So the center of mass of all of this stuff together must be somewhere above this little, I don't know, inch by 4 inch area. Otherwise, it wouldn't sit there stably. Okay? So center of mass is something that we can treat an extended object as if it were a point mass. And that makes a lot of our calculations a lot easier. Incidentally, on diagrams, it's often indicated kind of like on an X, kind of like that. Okay, so we can calculate the torque of gravity just by using the center of gravity as where the force of gravity is totally being applied. Well, let's take a look at, I think, commonplace notions. So if we have these two guys that are carrying a pipe up the stairs, who has to lift the hardest? The bottom one? Top one. It's a trick question. They have to lift exactly the same. So let's take a look at how we can calculate that. If we choose this as our origin, and this is going to be an important point for torques, we can choose the origin any place we want, and it's not going to twist around that. But if I choose the center of mass to be my origin, then this force, F2, is going to be a torque that's trying to twist it this way, counterclockwise, out of the page is what we would usually say. So we have this kind of right-hand rule to describe rotations. Put your fingers in the direction that it's going to rotate, and then the so-called direction of the rotation is the direction your thumb is going. So F2 is trying to twist it counterclockwise or out of the page, whereas F1 is trying to twist it clockwise, which is to say into the page. And it's not twisting, right? So this positive torque has to equal this negative torque. But I hope it's clear that they have exactly the same moment arm. So if they have the same moment arm and the torques have to cancel, they have to have exactly the same force. Okay. Now, if you've ever moved stuff, this may not seem correct. So let's say instead of moving a pipe, you're moving a mattress. Now who has to work harder? So the torque has to be zero. I can choose my origin any place I want, but I'm going to choose my origin to be the center of mass, because then the only external forces are this one and this one. This guy here has a, let's call it a negative torque, trying to twist it clockwise. This one has a torque that is F1 times D1. This one has a torque that is F2 D2, and you can see that D2 is bigger than D1. It's not rotating, so those torques have to be equal and opposite. And therefore, F1 has to be bigger than F2 because D2 is bigger than D1. Right? So it's working just kind of like a teeter-totter, where we have to have a bigger force to go with a shorter distance. Okay, so the sum of the forces have to be zero, the sum of the torques have to be zero. In order to solve these problems, we're going to be writing down those three equations all the time. And one of the first choices you're going to have to make in writing down those equations is what to choose for your origin. Okay, so if we look at this sort of situation, there are lots of forces that are acting on this rod, right? There's the weight of this guy, there's the weight of that guy, there's the tension in the string, and there's a normal force at this surface, and there's a frictional force at this surface. And we have to deal with the sum of the forces being zero and the sum of the torques being zero. Okay. Let's take a look at some of these problems. So the first problem is, kind of different. Doesn't seem to have much to do with this chapter. So what we've got, kind of a common situation, we've got this guy who is going to walk forward in this boat, and you know what's going to happen, right? When he pushes forward on the boat, or maybe I should say, when the boat pushes him forward, he's going to push the boat backwards with an equal and opposite force. So when he walks to the bow of the boat, the bow of the boat is going to have moved back some. And the question is, can he reach for this turtle that is here to start with? Okay. So how do we deal with this equal and opposite force situation? Well, if we have equal and opposite forces like this, then the center of gravity can't move. Well, maybe I should say it's going to move with a constant velocity, but in this particular case, the center of mass is not moving initially, so it can't move at all. So if we calculate the center of mass where it is at the start, it has to be at exactly the same point when we calculate the center of mass at the end. Okay, so I guess I haven't written the formula for center of mass because typically it's often more convenient to find it by the process I showed you before, by supporting something. But if you actually want to calculate the center of mass, what you do is you add up all of the masses and all of the positions, and you divide by the total mass. It's kind of the average location of the mass. So I claim the center of mass isn't going to move in problem 69. So if I add up the positions and the masses and divide by the total of mass, I do that at the start, I have to get the same thing I would get if I added up the positions and the masses divided by the total mass at the end. Now, of course, the canoe is a complicated object, but we can treat it as if it were a point particle at its center of mass. And the problem says that the canoe is symmetrical, so we know that the center of mass currently of this canoe is located at 3 meters plus 2 meters from the dock. Okay, so we've got some data. The kid weighs 40 kilograms. It's a pretty heavy canoe. I guess it's actually a boat. Weighs 70 kilograms. And the guy's going to walk from this end of the boat to that end of the boat. And of course, the boat is going to move at the same time. So we're supposed to figure out where the kid ends up. So notice, incidentally, that the masses are going to be the same before and after, so we can cancel those things out. So very quickly, we're just calculating the sum of the positions and the masses. So initially, if we use the dock as our origin, initially the guy is at 3 meters and he weighs 40 kilograms. The boat's a complicated object, but we can treat it as if it were at its center of mass. So 2 meters beyond the 3 meters. So these things all have to be the same. Well, where is the boat going to end up? Well, that's kind of what we want to calculate. So let's assume that in the final state, the end of the boat is at some distance x, which we don't know. So that means in the final situation, that 70 kilograms is going to be at location x. The buoy now is going to be at a location that is x plus 4 meters, because he's going to be at the other end of the boat. And we can use this then to solve for the location of the rear end of the boat. So we've got 3 times 40 plus 5 times 70 minus 3 times 4. Because I did it wrong. Thank you. And I erased the wrong things, right? So these are positions and masses. So the position of him is where the boat is plus 4, and he weighs 40 kilograms. Okay. So we've got 4 times 40 plus x times 40 plus x times 70. If we bring this 4 times 40 to the other side of the equation and combine these two guys, we've got 3 times 40 plus 5 times 70 minus 4 times 40 has to be x times 40 plus 70, which is 110. So x is going to equal all of this stuff. And of course, he's going to be just 4 meters further along, so we can see whether he can reach the turtle or not. I'm looking for my calculator. You see it? Oh, good. Okay. So we got 3 times 40, which is 120. We got 5 times 70, which is 350. And we've got 4 times 40, which is 160. Divide that all by 110, and I get 2.81 meters. Okay, so 2.81 meters, he's going to be out here at 6.81 meters. Okay, so the turtle is apparently at 7 meters. So if he reaches out 20 centimeters, he can reach for that turtle. Questions?
So you just added that 2.8.
Yeah, so this gave the 2.8 gave me the far end of the boat's location.
And then you just went out.
And then I just went out another 4 for where he is, because he's at the other end of the boat. So that was Oh, I'm sorry. I have screwed up. Yeah. So let me point out where I screwed up. So for the initial location of the canoe, I remembered to add the 2 meters that was at the center of mass of the location of the center of mass of the canoe, right? So this should have been x plus 2.
So can we just choose what the center of mass is? Or how are you saying that we found the center of mass?
So the in some sense, I haven't found the center of mass because I've never divided by m. But if I divide this side by m or I divide that by m, I have to get the same number, which is the location of the center of mass of the system. The center of mass of the canoe is halfway between the two ends. Because it's apparently a symmetrical canoe. So we've got 5 meters for it initially, and we've got x plus 2 meters for it finally. And he's going to be at x plus 4 if he's at the far end. Questions? Did I screw up here too or not? So what I get is the boy ends up at 5.5. So no, I have him not reaching it now. Let's run it through again. Won't hurt too much.
And the 5.5 is just added on to his original position?
No. Nope. So all my positions have been measured from the end of the dock.
Right.
So his initial position is 3. So this is his final position totally, his distance from the dock. Okay? Good to go? So if we carry this through, we've got this center of mass of the canoe being 2 meters beyond where the edge of the canoe is. So all that's going to do is to add in 2 times 70 to that side, and therefore subtract 2 times 70 from that side. So we still have got the 1,220, 3,500, 350, 160, and 140. And what I get is that this is 1.55 meters. And so he's 4 meters beyond that at 5.5 meters. Okay. So if there's no external forces, the center of mass has to move at a constant velocity. In this case, the initial velocity of the center of mass is 0, so the final position of the center of mass has to be the same. Okay, so here we've got a situation that's somewhat similar to that, except we've got this tension that's going up at the side. And at this end, we have a direct support force up and a push that's this way. In this case, they're being supplied by ropes, but that doesn't really much matter. And we're told what the weight of the person is and where he is located. So right off the bat, we can realize that we can treat this 2 meter plank of wood as if it were a point mass of 30 kilograms that's located at 1 meter. So if we draw up the picture, so here's this thing, here's the center of mass, which is located at 1 meter, and this thing weighs 30 kilograms, so 30 times g is going to be the force that's down. This guy is located at a distance d, and he has a weight of 700 newtons, and we have some unknown forces. T2 is up and T3 is to the side, in addition to this tension, T1. And we're supposed to find all of the tensions that are involved in the problem. Okay, so we've got 3 unknowns and we've got 3 equations, right? The sum of the forces in the x direction have to be 0, the sum of the forces in the y direction have to be 0, and the torque has to be 0. So if we look at the x direction first, there's a piece of T1 that's in the x direction. It's at an angle of 40 degrees, So this piece of T1, it's a side that's adjacent to 40 degrees. So this is T1 times the cosine of 40 degrees. The only other force that's in the x direction is T3. It's actually in the minus x direction. So the sum of the forces in the x direction is going to be T1 times the cosine of 40 degrees minus T3, and the sum of those forces have to be zero. If we look at the y direction, we've got a couple of things that are going down and a couple of things that are going up. So T2 is going up. This piece of the first tension is going up, and it's a sine that's opposite the angle. So it's going to be T1 times the sine of 40 degrees. Then we've got this weight, which is clearly down. And we've got this weight that's clearly down. And of course, to get the force on that 30 kilograms, we have to multiply it by the acceleration of gravity. Okay, so far we're not there, right? We've got two equations and three unknowns. We've got to have another equation. And that's going to be the torque equation. And that's the one that we have some choice about. Well, we have some trivial choice. We could choose this coordinate system oriented in different directions, but I can't imagine why you would ever do that. For torque, we have an arbitrary choice of origin. And we can choose it in order to make our calculation as simple as possible. And depending upon where you choose it, you're going to get different equations, but in the end, you have to get exactly the same answer. So for example, I could choose the origin to be right here, in which case the only torques would be that due to T2 and this weight and that weight. So that sounds like a pretty good deal. We would just have one unknown in one equation. Another option would be to choose the origin here, because then both T3 and T2 would have no torque because there's no lever arm for it. So the only torque would be due to this one of T1. Another not uncommon choice, I think it's not a particularly good choice for this problem, would be to choose either the center of mass or where this guy is. But that's going to leave lots of unknowns in our equation. So your choice.
If you chose that the left corner, wouldn't there also be the torque from standing on it?
Yes, there'll be three torques, okay. But there'll only be one unknown.
Okay.
T1 is the one thing we don't know. So where do you want to choose your origin?
That one?
So very commonly you're going to choose it to eliminate as many forces as possible, and here we eliminate two, so it seems like a pretty good deal. So the guy's weight is going to be twisting in the clockwise direction, and typically we're going to call that a negative torque. The weight of this plank acting at 1 meter is going to be a negative torque, and we're going to have a piece of T1 producing a positive torque. And the sum of those torques have to be zero. So what we've got is the equation for the torque of T1 is the radius vector, which is 2, the unknown force, which is T1, and the sine of the angle, which is 40 degrees. The other ones are all easier because they're all perpendicular cases. So the torque is just going to be literally the distance times the force, since the sine of 90 degrees is 1. So for the guy, we're going to have minus d times 700 newtons. And for the plank itself, we've got 1 meter, because we can treat it as if it were at its center of mass, times 30 g. So the sum of the torques have to be zero. OK? So this is nice, because we can immediately solve for T1. So we've got 2 T1 sine of 40 degrees. Put all the negative stuff on the other side of the equation. And notice that d is half a meter, so we have 1/2 times 700 plus 1 times 30 times 9.8. And if we solve for T1, we get T1 is all that stuff in the numerator, 1/2 times 700 plus 30 times 9.8, all on top of 2 times the sine of 40 degrees. Once I've got T1, I can plug it in there and get T2 or get T3. And I can plug it in here and get T1. So T2. So T1 is kind of the key. Once we've got it, we've got everything else from our force equations. Okay, so half of 700 is 350. And we've got 30 times 9.8. And we're going to divide that all by 2 and the sine of 40 degrees. And I get almost exactly 500 newtons, but in fact 501 newtons. Yes?
Is the 2 in front of T1 the distance from the origin that we picked to where T1 starts?
Yes. So I calculated, so there are lots of formulas for torque, and I could have used either one of them. So I could have thought of this as R times F times the sine of the angle. Or if I wanted to, I could have thought of this as R times F perpendicular, because the perpendicular piece of the force is T sine theta.
And the radius in this case is 2 then?
Mm-hmm. So the other possibility for torque would be to take this line of action and figure out what the perpendicular distance is. Way too complicated. It will give us the same answer. Okay, so once we know what T1 is, we can plug that in here. So T3 is what we want. T3 is going to be T1 times the cosine of 40 degrees. So I'll just have to punch cosine of 40 degrees and multiply that. And I get 384. And to get T2, I've got T2, put all this negative stuff on the other side of the equation, 700 plus 30 times G minus T1 times the sine of 40 degrees. I think I still have T1, so I need the sine of 40 degrees. And I've got 700 and 30 times G. And I get 672. That matches what I did the first time. Okay, so for statics problems, kind of the interesting new thing is choice of origin for the torque. You can choose it any place you want. You'll get the same answer no matter where you choose it. But choose it to give your equations, to make your equations as simple as possible. Typically choosing it to lie on top of lots of unknown forces. So let's take a look at 22. So this is kind of more similar to the situation we have over there. We've got a bear. And it's going to attempt to get this basket of goodies. The beam is uniform, and it has a weight of 200 newtons, and it's 6 meters long, supported by this wire, which is at an angle of 60 degrees. The basket weighs 80 newtons. Draw the force diagram, figure out what the tension of the rope is, and if you know that the maximum tension that this thing can support is 900 newtons, then figure out what's going on. Okay, so do notice, I hope it's clear that there are several obvious forces, right? There's the tension in the rope, there's the mass of the plank, there's the mass of the bear, but there's also that hinge. So that hinge is going to be supplying a force too. And I hope it's clear that because the tension is pulling it a little bit this way, that pin has to be pushing it a little bit that way. Has to be pushing it out, so it's canceling this little bit of tension that's pulling it in. The pin is also going to have to be supplying a force upward to support the weight of the bear and the plank. If you kind of guess wrong on a force direction, you'll just get a negative sign for it, so it's not a big deal to get that right at the start. Okay, so we've got a tension at 60 degrees, we've got the plank, which weighs 200 newtons, And we've got the bear that, at least initially, is at, where's the bear? 1 meter. And we have an unknown force that is lifting it at that pin. Let me call that just F1. And we've got an unknown force that is pushing it that way, which is F2. Okay, so some of the forces in the x direction has to be zero. Some of the forces in the y direction has to be zero. Some of the torques have to be zero. So let's do kind of the torque equation first. I think you can, again, you can choose your origin any place you want. You will get the same answer. But boy, it seems like this is the right place to choose your origin because it's going to eliminate two unknowns. Right? None of those have any lever arms, so the torque due to F1 and F2 are going to be zero. So the only torques are going to be the bear and the plank trying to twist it in the clockwise direction, and this tension that is going to try and push it in the counterclockwise direction. So I'll immediately be able to solve for that tension because it'll be the only unknown in the problem. Okay, so in detail then, the sum of the torques, no torque due to these guys because we've chosen the origin there. So we've got the bear at 700 newtons, and it's at a distance of 1 meter. And again, the angle between the force and where that's being applied is 90 degrees. So it's just simple multiplication. There's no sign of theta involved. We've got the plank, which is 200 newtons at a distance of 2 meters. And those are all clockwise forces, which I think the book has a tendency to call negative. The tension is pulling in the clockwise direction. So I've got T times R times the sine of the angle between them. Yes?
Oh, where's the 2 from? The
2 is from the 2 meters that the center of mass of the plank is from the 3 meters. Thank you. I was reconsidering that. More questions? Yes?
So if the bear and the plank are like twisting it clockwise, wouldn't the tension be pulling it counterclockwise?
Yes.
So why is that a positive tension?
So it's kind of an odd convention, but pretty commonly people call counterclockwise positive. It's a choice. You don't have to adopt that convention.
But I'm just saying, like, since they're opposite, wouldn't one be negative in this case? Oh, I don't know. There's also the weight of the basket.
Oh, thank you. The basket is at 6 meters, and it weighs 80 newtons. That's also... More corrections. Yeah, I think I've got all the problems in there. Okay, so we can solve for the tension by moving all this negative stuff to the other side of the equation. So we're going to have 700 plus 200 times 3 plus 80 times 6 is equal to T times 6 times the sine of 60 degrees. So the tension is going to equal that same numerator divided by 6 times the sine of 60 degrees. So we got 700 and 600. And 480, divide that all by 6 and the sine of 60 degrees, and I get 343 newtons. Okay, so that's the tension. If we look at the forces in the x direction, they're just two of them, right? F2 is in the positive x direction, and this piece of tension is in the negative x direction. This is a side that's adjacent to our angle 60 degrees, so this is going to be T times the cosine of 60 degrees. So in terms of the sum of the forces in the x direction, we've got F2, positive x direction, T cosine of 60 degrees in the negative x direction, and all of those things have to add up to zero. So F2 has to be T times the cosine of 60 degrees. And I get 172 newtons. Oops, 171 newtons. In the y direction, this guy's in the positive y direction. This piece of the tension's in the y direction. So this is going to be T times the sine of 60 degrees. And all of these other forces are in the negative y direction. So we've got F1 plus T times the sine of 60 degrees minus the weight of the bear, minus the weight of the plank, minus the weight of the goodies. All that has to add up to zero. So F1 has to equal all of the weight of the stuff less the amount of the weight that's being supported by the tension. So we've got the sine of 60 degrees, and we've got 980. And I get that this is 683 newtons. Okay. Okay, so here we have two frictionless surfaces. We have this rope that's going to be pulling horizontally to keep this ladder from slipping. There's, of course, going to be a normal force at this surface and a normal force at that surface, and the monkey's going to have some weight. So the monkey has a mass of 10 kilograms. The ladder weighs 120 newtons. We know the length of the ladder, and we're told that this angle is 60 degrees. So the sum of the forces have to be zero. Sum of the torques have to be zero. So if we draw our free body diagram, here at the bottom of the ladder, there's a normal force, let me call it N1, that's supporting it. That rope has some tension in it. It's pulling it that way. There's a surface up here that can have a normal force. Let me call it N2. And the ladder can be condensed to its center of mass, which is halfway, and it has a weight that is 120 newtons. And the monkey is, I think, two-thirds of the way up, isn't he? Yeah, two-thirds of the way up. Okay, some of the forces have to be zero, some of the torques have to be zero. So if we look at the sum of the vertical forces, it's kind of easy, right? The normal force at the floor has to be supporting all of the weight. If we look at the forces in the x direction, the tension in the rope has to be exactly canceling the normal force that's at the top, because those are the only forces that are in the x direction. So it's going to be the torque that's going to be the interesting problem. And with torque, we've got our choice. We can choose the origin. And it's a pure choice. You can choose it any place you want, and you'll get the same answer in the end. But the equation will look different depending upon where you choose the torque, the origin. And I think the most reasonable choice to choose the origin is that spot there, because I get to eliminate two forces for just one choice of origin. If I choose it there, then there's going to be a torque due to the mass of the ladder, there's going to be a torque due to the mass of the monkey, and there's going to be a counterbalancing torque that's due to that normal force. So there'll only be one unknown in that equation, namely the normal force, so I'll be able to get it basically instantaneously. And that's going to be the same as the tension, so I'll know the tension. And N1 was easy because it was just the weight of everything, because it's the only supporting vertical force. Okay, so I'm going to work this one a little bit differently and talk about the lever arm. So that's the perpendicular distance to the line of action of the force. So if I want to calculate the torque of the monkey, I need this distance, this horizontal distance, from the line of action of that force to my origin. And I know that 2/3 is a nice number, so the monkey is 2 meters up the ladder. So this distance, r perpendicular, is going to be 2 times the cosine of 60 degrees. This perpendicular distance to the center of mass of the ladder is going to be half of the distance of the ladder, 3/2, times the cosine of 60 degrees. Okay, so I'm intentionally using one of the different formulas we have for torque. We've got r perpendicular f, we've got rf perpendicular, or rf times the sine of the angle between them. They all have to give the same answer. Okay, so similarly, the line of action of this force is this distance here. So r perpendicular for this one is going to be 3 meters times the sine of 60 degrees. So what we've got then is the normal force has an r perpendicular that is 3 times the sine of 60 degrees. It's a positive torque because it's trying to twist it counterclockwise. For the monkey, we've got a force that is the monkey's weight times g times this distance here, which is 2 times the cosine of 60 degrees. And we've got the weight of the ladder, which is 120 newtons times its moment arm, which is 3/2 of the cosine of 60 degrees. So the sum of those torques has to add up to 0. So N2, which you remember has to equal the tension in the rope, put all that negative stuff on the other side of the equation. 10 times 9.8 times 2 times the cosine of 60 degrees plus 120 newtons times 3/2 times the cosine of 60 degrees, all on top of 3 times the sine of 60 degrees. Now, I remind you that this normal force is just the total weight, so it's going to be the 120 newtons plus the mass of the monkey times g. Okay. So if you look at the remaining parts of the problem, what they do is they say, instead of having this rope, we could hope that the frictional force would be what's holding the ladder in place. It doesn't fundamentally change the problem. Okay, so quiz on this sort of stuff, statics, next time. Test on Thursday. So you found...
Strangely, I couldn't find the bottle in Wilford's office.
This was in Wilford's office? I looked for it.
It's in that bookshelf, top shelf, just laying some papers and stuff.
So
I don't know if that's the elegant one that I think I remember seeing.
This looks homemade.
Yeah, it's got a card stuck on there for balance, I guess.
Well, probably to make it flatter.
Yeah.
So the one I've got is also homemade.
Oh, you did find one. You didn't need this thing.
That one. But that also, well, it also is homemade.
You just make it like today?
No, I found it, but you can see that it's, you know,
yeah,
got the loving hands of home on it.
Yeah, not really made for a bottle. Perhaps.
Next Thursday is when I get my surgery on my leg, so can I take the test on Wednesday?
Sure.
That'd be possible.
So you want to take it early? You can take it late.
Let's get all the pain over with as soon as possible.
I'm on pain meds on that Wednesday, that next Monday and Tuesday,
okay.
So I'd rather just get it done with earlier.
What time on Wednesday?
Are we going to do the review on Tuesday or Wednesday?
So I can't say how people are going to vote, but last time, and so we could actually decide this after we decide that, but last time we voted for Tuesday night.
If I could do the review Tuesday night and then take it Wednesday, what is it going to be? Is it this? No, it'll be the day before. I'll be done with class at 11:20, or after 11:20. So I can come in at 1.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Take it then, something like that.
So why don't you drop me some email? Okay. Might as well wait until after we've done the review, after we've decided on the review session.
Right. Yeah. Perfect. Thank you.
Dean, the other thing that's, I think, I found a use for that box.
Hey. Wow. You can simulate all these weird problems in the box. That's just
friction, yeah.
Wow.
And it is kind of interesting because it doesn't work. I mean, obviously you have to have a big normal force, so I need this guy in order to cause a big tension.
Oh, I see. Without this, this wouldn't do it.
Well, I don't know if literally that's true or not, but it doesn't do very well when I take this off.
Oh, yeah.
There, he said.
Sandpaper between the surfaces.
I thought about actually putting sandpaper there to make it work better. Huh. Oops, I want to put this guy in here too, so I can have roving bears.
Yeah. Well, that's nice. That does give a lot more of a feel for the concept of the normal force.
Yeah, I think it has.
In there and see if it hurts.
I think it has some potential.
Now, what about this?
The record player was just out because they don't know. They may not know what a record player is. So.
Oh yeah. Okay. The problem requires them to know. Oh, so you found the bottle.
Ellen had I think it's probably leftover, and it's pretty carefully balanced. So Ellen had a leftover bottle of, I think, biology wine. And you can see that thermal expansion is leaking it, but I figure I'll wait till it's all over before I...
So we're in a hot place here.
Compared to the inside of a refrigerator.
Oh, yeah. Wow, you got a deck full of toys. It's always fun to see. Did you amaze them with this one?
I did, kind of.
Without explaining it?
I explained it eventually.
Okay.
I was surprised you didn't ask about this thing.
I usually use that for, I don't usually use that, but I think I've seen it for Archimedes.
Oh.
If you wanted to know the density of bone.
Oh. I use it for center of mass of a complicated object.
Oh, it's a great complicated
object. It has to be below that, and it has to be below that, so those two lines only intersect at one point, so you don't have to add up the masses in order to.
That's very nice. Did they seem to follow that explanation?
I don't know. I didn't get a chance to get that, but I found it.
That's a really dense piece of wood.
Well, I mean, of course, the purpose is you say, well, of course, for a uniform object, the center of mass is in the center.
Oh, but it's weighted.
You can feel it.
It's a bad cork.
It's,
oh, yeah.
It's definitely weighted.
I didn't know that existed.
Where did
you find it?
It was in with the mechanic stuff. Oh. I, of course, thought at first it was a uniform piece of wood, which I was going to use for that. But
even better. Very nice. I want to take your class.
You've been recorded, so you can't...